You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
My name is Greg Shad. An honor and a privilege to join you here at XSI today and to get to share with you all on this topic. My background a little bit, I did youth ministry for a few years out of college, and then when I turned 30, I started sleeping all night on senior high retreats, and that becomes very career limiting. And so I had to move into the counseling space, you know. I like to tell people I'm in therapy every day. Really, it's okay. Been doing that for about 25 years. So it's definitely a privilege and honor to share with you, and especially on this topic of trauma. We're going to look at trauma. We're going to look at some things that aren't trauma that might have some connections or maybe not. And then we're going to look at some resiliency things, which I think is really important when we're talking about understanding trauma and what can we do to either maybe be shored up a little bit for when those really difficult things happen, or if difficult things have happened, how do we build some strengthening muscles to be able to deal with and heal from those difficult things. And so we'll be kind of covering that stuff. Topic of trauma obviously is a very large topic, and we've got a very small amount of time. So one of my cowardly disclaimers is that I'm going to miss a lot. There's a lot of stuff. You go, well, he didn't even bring up this, or boy, I thought he would at least mention that. Well, I want to apologize in advance for the things that you're not going to hear, and hopefully you'll have other resources to kind of dig deeper and explore more if this is a topic that's really resonating with you or that you have a lot of interest in. So that's important. The other thing is that I did this same, supposedly, talk yesterday, right? Now, I don't know how close this is going to approximate what I said yesterday, because quite frankly, even though I've got an outline here, I never know exactly what's going to come out of my own mouth. So having said that, I just want to apologize also in advance if I offend you or say something that's really hurtful, okay? And so I just want to apologize. I'm sorry. I'm not intending to hurt you or say something, you know, offensive. If the people that you know around you, if they all got hurt and offended and you didn't and you feel left out, come on, see me afterwards and we'll take care of that. Okay. All right. So let's dive in. So the definitions of trauma. I mean, one of the things that has motivated this topic as well is that in the field of traumatology, and that's actually a science, the study of trauma, in the last 30 years, there have been very significant advances, both in understanding what trauma is and in how to address it with people, and also, to some extent, how to prevent it. And so I'm not going to parallel it exactly like technology, but the advances in traumatologies just continue, and it's pretty amazing. It's really pretty amazing, and to be in this field for these years, it's like, oh, wow, that's new, that's different, about every, I don't know, 6 months. And so, which is really cool because more people get helped, right? What's also difficult about it, though, is that trauma has become kind of a term in our common lexicon, and so we toss this term around very casually, and as a clinician, that really irritates me, because it's like a big deal, it's a big thing, it's a real thing, and so to just kind of like toss around like, hey, I broke my fingernail, I'm traumatized, I'm like, oh, I'm gonna have to hit you. So I want to look at that to the extent that we can over grab for trauma sometimes. And so that's kind of like a anti-resiliency kind of thing that our culture is really pushing on us. Our current society is really encouraging us to be as mentally unhealthy as possible. We're not going to get into all that because that's probably another whole conversation. But suffice to say, That trauma is a way to really exaggerate and to terrorize and scare people. And so it's become this common thing that we kind of toss around casually. We over-exaggerate. So that's some of the motivation behind kind of what we're doing here and why we're doing it. So we'll look at definitions and traditional understanding, say 20 years ago or so. We typically understood trauma as a life-threatening event or a traumatic event. A life-threatening event or an event which could seriously injure or damage a person, which activates the person's fight-or-flight mechanism. It activates their alarm system and overwhelms the person's mental, physical, and emotional resources, spiritual resources. It's just an overwhelming event that has kicked in their alarm system and they're not able to stop. And so that's still a very relevant definition and still one that is used. It's very, very well accepted. But really in the last 30 years, it hasn't been replaced, but it's been expanded upon. Because what people in the field have realized is that a lot of things that don't necessarily meet or fit this definition really closely are having the same kind of effects that these kinds of situations are having. And so there's been a need to really understand or to expand our understanding of what a traumatic event or what trauma or what a trauma experience really is. And so I've grabbed from one of the leaders in this field, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. Some of you may have heard of his book, The Body Keeps the Score. It was pretty groundbreaking in terms of bringing to the general public some things that were really helpful in recognizing unresolved trauma in one's life and kind of how that was working. So a couple ideas that he brings forth in terms of the definition of trauma. That's an event which overwhelms the central nervous system and changes the way the person remembers and reacts to things that remind them of the event or experience. Second, when our fight or flight alarm system is activated, which affects our whole being, and the person does not quickly recover or return to a pre-experience level of calm. And so it's like it kicked on, and it, even though the event is over, it's not really kicking off. We're still like percolating, okay, and maybe for a long time. And so something that happens to a person which is overwhelming and significantly damages or destroys the foundations for the person's sense of safety, which is really key. So if something happens where you go, I thought the world was at least this safe, and now I'm 100% certain it is not. So everything I based my sense of safety or security and even identity on is now in question because this was just such an overwhelming experience. Trauma experience, kicking on that fight or flight, what happens with our memory often is that, you know, like in a normal day, you go through a day and things happen. And so if I say, okay, let's see, so it's July 15th, like, what were you doing 2 years ago, July 15th? You're like, unless it's your birthday, unless you got married, unless there was some significant event, good or not so good, you'd probably be like, I have no idea. I mean, I guess I could go look at my calendar, you know, but we don't tend to remember things very vividly. It's like in our memory, it gets written daily in pencil. And, you know, over time, that kind of fades. And wow, my voice faded right there. Cool. It kind of fades, and so we don't remember it. But a traumatic experience is even stronger than, like, getting written in pen. It's like it gets embossed. It's like this memory gets embossed into our brain. And so when I was talking to a friend, you know, several years ago, and he was telling me about his experience as a six-year-old, finding out that his brother, his teenage brother, died in a car crash. And he says, I remember I was sitting there, and my parents put me on the counter, and I was looking down, and I had these red Keds on and this yellow shirt. And I'm like, wow. So that was like 30 years ago. What were you wearing the day before? And he's like, what do you mean? What was I wearing the day before? I was six. It was 30 years ago. I'm like, right. But you could see, you can still see in your mind's eye those yellow Keds. I mean, those red Keds and that yellow shirt. I'm like, absolutely. Because that's what a traumatic experience can do. It can just bang, imprinted on our memory. And so when trauma is not resolved, that imprinting and the intensity and the feelings, the memories of the feelings, maybe the auditory, not rarely, but maybe the olfactory, but the olfactory sense, and also this little thing that I believe very, very strongly that the enemy does, the enemy takes that opportunity to insert a lie about the person that says, if you were good enough or strong enough or lovable enough or fast enough or responsible enough or worth anything, this wouldn't have happened. And it comes out into this sense of like, well, I'm obviously just a dirty person. I'm obviously just worthless. And that lie, ooh, that's the thing I love most about helping people through is when they're like, I knew that that lie was not true here, but right down in my gut, I couldn't quite believe it. But now I believe it. That's a lie, and I believe God's truth for me. Wow, that's healing. Okay, that's resolving trauma. And so all this stuff gets kind of stuck. These memories, these emotional experiences, this lie, and then it kind of becomes a lens through which we view our new experiences. And so, if, let's say, I was in a car accident, I'm going to use kind of a car accident as a basic kind of universal traumatic experience. If I was in a car accident, somebody's like, hey, we're going to get some food. You want to go? I'm like, no, it's okay. And they're like, what's going on? Well, I don't really ride in cars. I don't really ride in cars anymore. And they're like, "What, dude, that was 2 years ago. And you go, well, I'm okay, really. You know, part of me says it's okay to not ride in cars. I mean, what's the big deal? It's not great. Cars aren't that great. You know, there's other ways. Like, God gave me feet, so that's good. And then part of me's like, man, something's really wrong with me. And so trauma, unresolved trauma, can give us a sense of, like, I'm not okay. Not like, oh, I broke my arm, and so, you know, I'm not okay because my arm's really messed up, but the me of me is okay. It's just now I got to deal with this arm. Trauma and unresolved trauma has a way of saying, no, you at the very core of your identity are not okay. You're crazy. You're messed up. You're not right. Something's wrong with you. Something's wrong with you at that deep identity level. And that's a lie. But trauma makes it incredibly convincing, and it does it in part by, and that's why I say I think it's the enemy, by bringing that lie into that situation when we are physically completely queued up, we're completely on hyperdrive, and that's when that lie comes right in with all that other stuff. So that's a sense of a little bit about what trauma is, and what happens is that when it gets stuck, it doesn't dissipate. You know, so a lot of times, if we experience something really difficult over a few days, a couple weeks, or whatever, that intensity of like, oh my gosh, that was really intense, or that was really hard, it tends to kind of dissipate. And so, you know, a week later or 2 weeks later, it doesn't feel as intense when we think about it. We're kind of assimilating that information into our understanding and into our history and things like that, and so we're not kicked in as if we were there. If somebody is experiencing, so it's normal to have these really significant responses to a significantly traumatic event, a day, a few days, a week, a couple weeks later, to have like a wow, like I'm having some nightmares, or I'm having some like I like cry and I don't know why, or I'm like afraid to sleep, or I just can't stop thinking about this stuff. I feel queued up all the time. I can't eat. And so that's there's some normalcy to that because of the level of the event and how we were overwhelmed. But what we want to see is that dissipates. And so if that's a very intense time initially, it can reach some pretty intense levels, and we would call that, clinically, we would call that an acute stress disorder, or an acute stress reaction, right? And so we can get some help for that. You're not allowed to claim PTSD like 5 days after the car accident. You can't do it. Nobody will let you. Okay, so don't say it's PTSD. All right, you got to wait 30 days. Okay. Sorry. I know. I want to claim my PTSD really fast too, but it dissipates. But if it's still there after 30 days and it's still like we're still percolating or the memories are still kicking in this fight or flight or things are still vivid or we're still having nightmares or intense recollections or intrusive thoughts or things like that, after 30 days, that's where we move into that kind of diagnostic space of post-traumatic stress disorder. And that doesn't usually necessarily just go away. And so if that's something that you've experienced or somebody you care about has, it's really helpful to get professional help for that. Because it just, again, it doesn't necessarily just tend to fade away after that length of time. Right? So one of the things in the field that's been important is that there are different kind of types of trauma. Like we're talking, like what I've kind of used as an example right here is like an event, like a one event, a one episode kind of thing. Okay, and so as the field has understood trauma more broadly, I listed these kind of four things. People, they're different lists or different categories, but I picked these four because I kind of think I resonate with them. So complex or relational trauma, and this is where we've got multiple experiences, multiple traumatic experiences, so things in the range of that traumatic experience where somebody maybe not fully recovered from the last one and then something else happens. And so these things kind of compound, or it's like a relationship where there's a lot of traumatic stuff that happens where we're starting to experience some of the symptoms of a PTSD, but maybe we haven't gone through one specific event that was in and of itself this overwhelming life-threatening thing. The other is an environmental trauma. We can live in environments where the safety is just simply not there. And maybe it's there, not there, and then it's there again. So we're really not sure about whether we're safe or not. You know, sometimes people in really difficult neighborhoods where there's a lot of violence going on, or a home where there's a lot of chaos and a lot of violence, or a lot of difficult things going on. This can be more of an environmental trauma. And the last there is the developmental trauma, where this kind of suggests that the trauma or traumatic experiences have happened at a time in somebody's development, in a person's development, where that stage of development, they're missing some of the benefits of that stage of development. They don't kind of get the benefit of that particular time of growth and development. And so we find later that they had some traumatic experiences and it kind of robbed them of some of these resources. And so helping recover from their traumatic experience might mean we help them regain or learn some resources that the trauma prevented during an important developmental stage. So we're gonna skip the next section because you can read it. Let's look at some key symptom clusters. One of the things I did, because I know some people are like, hey, I want more information on this specifically. So one of the handouts, the one pager, is just, I totally lifted that from the Mayo Clinic's website. It says mayoclinic.org. And since it wasn't a link, I separated it out there. But that just like is a copy of like, here's what they say, basic PTSD and the basic symptoms within the clusters. That's it. It's got some other information. So you can kind of get into that later if you'd like. But the four kind of key clusters of symptoms when trauma is unresolved is that we re-experience it, you know, whether that's, again, in the form of nightmares or intrusive memories or intrusive recollections. The other cluster is that we're going to avoid anything that reminds us of that or that we think has the potential to remind us of our traumatic experience. And so maybe I don't want to go into an auto parts store because of the car accident. Now, that might seem like it. Boy, auto parts store and a car accident seems pretty not real connected. But if for me and the way that trauma's messing with me, I can't go into an auto parts store without getting like reactivated, then I'm going to kind of avoid it, right? It's not going to be a fun thing. Like, hey, no, you go to the auto parts store. I'm good. And so we can avoid those things. And we kind of, over time, we can accommodate that avoidance. We can manage our life in a way that we don't have to go there. You know, I live in the city now, so I don't really have to drive. Like, I save in car insurance. It's a great deal. And people are like, oh, that's great. And they don't know you're going, because I'm never getting in a car again, you know. So then there's hyperarousal, and that's just a reactivation of the alarm system. Okay? And so it's like our spidey sense kicks on. It's like, uh-oh, something's not right. And that alarm is like, man, when I got traumatized back here, I didn't see it coming, so I'm going to be hypervigilant. I'm going to always be on yellow. I'm going to always be on, like, yellow alert. I'm going to have my head on a swivel. I'm going to be queued up, and it's not going to get me this time. Okay. And so that hyperarousal, reactivation, or just that vigilance. Okay. And one of the things about the avoiding and the hyperarousal, those two clusters, is that the thought we tend to have is that those are going to keep us safer. If I avoid things like it, and my head's on a swivel, and I'm queued up, and I'm ready to go at any minute, then I'm safer. This is actually not true. Okay? We want to recalibrate that alarm system. We want to get it reset back to, like, it works when there's an emergency, and it doesn't kick on when there's not. Think about having a house alarm. You have an alarm in your house or your apartment. Every 12 times, it's a legit once. You'd be like, I hate that stupid alarm system. I don't even pay attention to it anymore, hardly, but it just, I can't, you know, it's so annoying. It's not a helpful alarm system. But if that alarm system only goes off 3 times for every one time there's an actual event, you're like, man, thank God for that alarm system, right? It's working pretty good. So we don't want an alarm system that's always kicking in. That's not helpful. It's really kind of just annoying. Not good. Probably isn't fun for the people around us when that happens. Not that it's about them. It's about us. But, you know, just thinking about maybe being thoughtful. I don't know. Skip that part. We'll erase that on the tape. Anyway. And just because we're in a traumatic event, we have a traumatic, like, what should be a traumatic experience, doesn't mean that it's not going to resolve, or that we're going to have PTSD or some unresolved trauma. One of the cool things that God allowed me to experience when I was 5 was I was in a plane crash. It was sweet, okay? It was cool. I did not get traumatized. I was like, wow, that was really intense. You know, we were like flying this little plane. My dad was a pilot, and my brother was in the co-pilot seat because he was 7. And so I was in the back seat because I was 5, and my mom and my little sister are over at Don Scott because we had some work done on the plane, and we're going over to Port Columbus or John Glenn or whatever to fly to Florida. And so the boys are flying, and the girls are driving around 270, and on the radio there's a report, blue and white private plane just crashed on 270. No further information is available right now. I don't know how my mom handled that exactly, but it was pretty clear that was us. And all 3 of us walked away. We all walked away from it. The plane was mangled. I mean, it was a mangled mess. Funny thing, like a couple weeks later, my kindergarten class taking a field trip to the airport. And we're walking by, and there's all these planes parked out there. And I'm like, that's my dad's plane. And they're like, oh, that pretty red one. I'm like, no, that blue and white one. And they're like, ugh, that's not a good-looking plane. I'm like, it's kind of not anymore, is it? But I wasn't traumatized. Could have been. I'll tell you what, if I was the only survivor, might have been a different story, right? So there are a lot of factors that go into whether we're going to recover pretty well or whether maybe something's going to get stuck. But we never really kind of know. I mean, we can look at the data, like certain kinds of traumatic event, X percentage of people experience PTSD, and then other kinds of events, maybe less percentage. You know, it seems that the human and intentional traumas that we experience, we're more likely to experience a higher incidence of PTSD, okay? But that plane crash might not have had much of an effect. Whatever intensity kind of dissipated fine, and no fallout, nothing stuck. Maybe 2 weeks later, some, you know, big mean second grader, you know, roughs me up for my lunch money. And maybe 20 years later, I'm like, hey, I can't eat lunch. I want to kill that guy, you know, because that one got me, you know. So it's hard to know, but that hopefully that kind of helps. Some challenging things that are not trauma, okay? And this is kind of important. And like stress is not trauma. Things that are very stressful or difficult, hardships, it's not trauma. And so we need to not say, well, I was traumatized by this. Like, so God, because he's merciful and gracious, apparently to you, but not me, he gave me an example of stress this past Sunday that I could use right here, like a fresh example. Because I'm like, I wonder what kind of stressful example. And then God's like, I'll give you one. So Sunday afternoon, I went to my office and I'm like, I'm going to do my outline for XSI and the talk and just get that finished. I got all day and this is going to be fine. And then I'll send it to Kim and she'll print it out. And everything's cool because I'm really slammed, you know, Monday through Wednesday, and should be great. And then I walked down to the basement to get some water, to get it like a bottle of water. And there was water down there. There's like 2.5 inches of water down there everywhere. So I spent the next, 9 hours getting a sump pump and putting it in. And my wife came in and we spent all that time like getting boxes and stuff thrown away and fans and mopping and squeegeeing and trying to get the place so that it wasn't, you know, a disaster flood zone. That was not traumatic. That was hard. I might have expanded my vocabulary a little bit. But it's not trauma. I didn't go away going, I'm stupid, I'm an idiot. Gosh, I'm so worthless, I'm an idiot. Okay? Or if I did, I didn't do it for very long because it's over now. You've got the handouts. You don't even know that I didn't just do that leisurely, right? Doesn't look very stressful, does it, the handout? No. And I'm not having after effects, like nothing's percolating or twitching. You know, it's like, okay, whew, get a little rest, we're good. Losses are not necessarily trauma, okay? And that's important. That can be a tricky one, because a loss is loss, particularly of loved ones, can be really overwhelming, and it can definitely overwhelm our emotional, mental, physical, spiritual resources. Okay, but they're not. So they can be traumatic, but they're not necessarily traumatic. Okay, that's an important distinction, because we say, well, wait, I had this loss and I think it was pretty traumatic. It might have been, but just because it's a significant loss does not mean that it's traumatic. Okay, and so I think about grief as the healing process from the injury of the loss. I don't believe that, you know, if we lost a dear loved one or something, or we had a loss of something that was really significant to us, 20 years later, that loss may still be very significant to us. And so we don't get over it, okay? But we can heal from the pain of the initial injury of that loss. And so I think I kind of see that the grief process is the process of healing from the injury that the loss created, okay? But we accommodate, we assimilate, we incorporate the loss into our story at some point, sometimes very reluctantly, and maybe always reluctantly. But it's not the same as trauma, so necessarily. Failure, my own failure, not necessarily the same as trauma. You know, if I fail a test that was really important, it may be really hard. I may have some real self-deprecating thoughts, you know. Like, man, I should have cheated on that test in medical school, but I didn't, and I got kicked out. I'm like, it's not true. I'm not smart enough to get into medical school, so it's an exaggeration. But yeah, our failures are not generally traumatizing, and so we want to be careful not to put things that are not traumatic into the trauma bucket, okay? Because then we're kind of committing to experiencing that traumatically. So that's just not helpful. So healing, when I think of that, it means that a very, very general understanding of what healing is. It means that the pain stops and the functioning is restored, okay? So if I get a big cut on my arm, it's going to hurt, right? For me, it would. Big cut, hurts, pain, ouch. And I'm going to like not want to wear a coat over it. I don't want to carry the firewood. Maybe it gives me an excuse to not hug people. I mean, so it could come in handy. Or it could be really messing with my functioning, right? Healing means that it doesn't hurt anymore. That whatever, and so emotionally or psychologically, that means the reservoir of emotional pain and stuff and fear and all of that doubt and all that emotional stuff, that reservoir of stuff is gone. And the functioning, whatever adjustment I had to make or change I had to make to accommodate this injury, I've overcome that, and I am back to functioning fully as if the event didn't happen. Okay. Now, a couple things about that. One is that healing is not an all or nothing thing. I can have a partial healing on my arm where it's like the functioning is fine, but I can tell when it's going to rain, you know? So you go, okay. Or we could have maybe a limitation in the functioning. Broke my ankle. Doctor's like, you're going to have 90% rotation on your ankle. It's like, are you a professional athlete, like a professional basketball player? I'm like, you didn't measure my height coming in, no. He's like, then you'll be fine, okay? Probably won't even notice it, okay? Healing doesn't necessarily have to be 100% in both of those categories. And we could experience 5% healing, or 30% healing, or 83% healing, okay? And so it's important to know that's true physically, that's also true psychologically. The other thing is that scars aren't necessarily indications of something that's not healed. Okay? Maybe I have a scar on my arm, okay, from the cut, but the pain is gone and the functioning is fully restored. That's fully healed. But there's a scar. There's a reminder. Okay? Scars are reminders. Okay? But they don't have to be triggers. They don't have to vault us back to that event. Okay, and so when we're healed, like with a trauma, we can talk about the traumatic experience if we choose to, and we don't have to be teleported back to that moment. We don't have to be like go back and experience all that stuff and it ruins our day or our week, or like now we gotta like do something because it just brought it all back fresh. It's like, no, when that's healed, we can talk about it. It may still be sad, there may still be some pain about it. It may still be angering or upsetting, but it's like it happened in the past. It's not happening right now. And so we have some distance from it, okay? And so I guess I say that to say scars or reminders are okay. That's not what we're trying to heal or get rid of. A friend of mine I just saw had a bumper sticker on his car. It says, scars are just tattoos with better stories. And I thought that was cool because I don't have any tattoos, but I do have a lot of scars, so I appreciated that. Although some tattoos, you know, there's some stories, but we won't get into that. Again, different conference. All right. So now, if you're really interested in, like, getting you some trauma, but you don't want to go through the experiences to get it, here are some techniques that you can use. All right. It's real important because these are things our society, our current society right now, is really encouraging us to do. Okay, so if you want to appropriate yourself some post-traumatic stress, a couple tips coming up, right? First, awfulize and catastrophize. The bigger, more awful you can make it, whew, that's going to help. If you're like, man, I can't believe it, you know? I got laid off that job I hate. You know, how am I going to ever work again? I mean, that's a traumatic experience. That's awful. Like, I don't even know. I mean, you know, like, actually, it's like great because now you can get a job that you like. you know. And friends are going, didn't you hate that job? Didn't you have like stupid hours that didn't work with your life? Didn't they pay you like garbage? You're like, yeah, but I mean, what does it say about me? Well, we could awfulize and catastrophize. That's helpful. All right. Ooh, that fell down. Part of the thing, first of all, I'm going to backtrack a second. Minimizing isn't good. Okay? If somebody gets hurt, if we get hurt, or somebody's hurt, we don't want to minimize that. So minimizing an experience or an event is not good. We don't appreciate if somebody's minimizing. We're like, hey, yeah, I lost my arm. They're like, well, at least you have another one. Like, that feels minimizing, right? So a couple things right off the top of my head I can think about why that's not helpful is that, first of all, minimizing disrespects the person that went through this experience. It says, man, this experience was nothing. You should be fine, right? This shouldn't have an effect on you, okay? And that minimizing, so it's kind of disrespectful. If we're minimizing it for ourselves, kind of disrespectful to ourselves that we've really been through something. Certainly disrespectful of others. The second thing right off the top of my head is we can't appropriately address any accountability that needs to happen, right? And so if somebody hurts me in some way, and it's like, I'm like, oh, yeah, well, whatever, and everybody around is like, oh, you know, no biggie, that happens. I'm like, well, it was kind of a felony, okay? If I'm minimizing, we're never going to address the accountability that might need to happen, or maybe the policy or the circumstances that need to be addressed and looked at because this is the thing that happened, okay? So that's why minimization isn't good. But on the other hand, maximization is not good either. A couple things there. First of all, it's disrespectful to person. If I'm maximizing something that happened to me, I'm disrespecting that I have the strength and I have the coping skills and I have the capacity to handle this. Okay? I'm a pretty strong person. And so this thing doesn't need to be super awful and it's the catastrophe and it's the worst thing that ever happened. Kind of disrespectful to myself to not appreciate and own the strength I have. Secondly, I mean, if I'm awfulizing, catastrophizing to my wife's usually very reasonable, so not to her. She'd be like, you're awfulizing, catastrophizing. But let's say I was doing that to my mom. My mom would be like, all right, I'm not pacifist anymore. I'm going to kill him. Okay, the accountability, again, there's no sense of like accountability because now everybody's up in arms over something that's not really that big a deal. And so we miss the accountability. We don't do appropriate justice. We don't do appropriate adjustments. We're adjusting things that actually don't matter because we've maximized something. All right, something to play with. Second thing we can do if we're really trying to get some trauma going, we can offense seek. Microaggressions, great, great way to offense seek. Okay, like my friend says, Greg, he gave me the brush, man. I said, hi, when I saw him, he's like, and walked right on by. He just kept walking. Oh my gosh, I can't believe it. He just nodded. He didn't even slow down. He's such a racist loser. You know, if I were short and fat like him, you know, he would have said, oh, hi, but no, I'm tall and I have good nutrition. So, you know, and he hates people like that. So he's a heightist. He's a heightist. He probably doesn't even have a clue how bigoted he is, right? He's one of them. Okay, nice work. When actually me going like, hi, was like, I'm looking for a restroom. Like, I'd love to hang out and talk, but you know, got other things on my mind right now. Has that ever happened to you? Yeah, actually it's never happened to me. Anyway. Philippians 2:3, do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourself. Scripture encourages us to give people the benefit of the doubt, to look upon them positively. Okay. Our sense of if we're the only ones, if safety is up to us, then we need to be hypervigilant about the anger or the hatred or the potential violation that might come from somebody like that. But if we're trusting our awesome God And he says, it's okay. You can love people. You can look upon them maybe more positively than they are. And please don't look upon them more negatively than they are. All right? The Lord gives us that capacity as we walk with him. And so that offense seeking gives us this sense of hypervigilance, a little bit of trauma, right? Cool. So the other all or nothing thinking, this is another way we can kind of appropriate ourselves some trauma. Some people are naturally a little more black and white thinkers, a little this or that, and some people a little more gray area. I'm not really talking about that personality kind of thing. I'm talking more about, like, are you pro or con? Are you red? Are you blue? Are you pro-gun? Are you anti-gun? Are you pro-gay marriage or do you hate people? Are you pro-choice or are you pro-life? Right? We just had that one recently, right? Pro-choice, pro-life. So somebody asked me, hey, Greg, you pro-choice or pro-life? And I'm like, yes. And they're like, yes? I'm like, yes. And they're like, you can't just be yes. And I'm like, oh, okay, no. No. So you just want me to say, okay, well, tell you what, let me give you the two-sentence answer, which is, you know what, I'm pro-life, and I'm pro-life, I'm pro-choice because I love everybody. So that's what I am. I'm yes. I love everybody. I'm going to love everybody. And what I don't want to do is be stuffed into your little box. I don't want to be stuffed into your camp, because if I'm in your camp, then we go, ooh, yeah, you're in my camp. Yeah, yeah, we're going to tote guns around, shoot people, sweet, right? Okay, we're going to have a party. But then all these other people, we have to hate them. Okay, they have to be our new enemies. And I don't want that. Or if I'm on that side, then these people have to be my enemies. I have to be against them. I don't want to be for these people and against all these people. Okay? That's not helpful. Okay? That's like taking my identity and boiling it down into, like, here it is. If you want to know what I really think about pro-choice or pro-life, what we should do is we should sit down and we should have a long conversation. And it will include things like, well, I really think, and I kind of feel, and boy, I'm not so sure about, and some maybes, and a lot of listening. And by the time we get done with that 1 or 2 hour conversation, I might go, I don't know if I'm in a different place. I don't know if I'm in the same place. But it was really good to have this conversation, because this is a really complex and messy issue. It is really a complicated issue. And so many of these things that our society is trying to stuff us into some yes, no, blue, red, you know, up, down box is not healthy. It's not helpful. It's not healthy. And especially as a therapist, I'm going to tend to not tell you where I stand, because that would basically eliminate half of my income, right? I have people that, oh, well, he's on our side, so I'll go see him, you know. And other people are like, well, he's against us, so I'm not going to go see that guy. He's probably a quack anyway, which might be true, but I don't want him to know that because of my social stances. Although, you want to know what I think about where Jesus would stand on a gun thing? You want to know? I have a real specific stance on that. Like, where would Jesus stand today on the carry a gun or not? Right? Anybody want to know what my position is on that? Okay, I saw a hand, so I'm going to tell you. All right? I'm going to tell you. Now, you may walk away going, okay, this guy does not know how to rightly divide the word. He's not right in the head. But as I read scripture, there's that story about Jesus in Gethsemane, right? And he drinks the cup. And after he drinks the cup and he wakes his disciples up who are asleep on a job, they're supposed to be praying. And here come the troops. They're going to arrest Jesus. What happens? Peter was carrying. He pulls out his concealed weapon, and he goes to whack the dude over the head, try to split his head off, right? But he missed. He didn't go like, I'm going to cut your ear. No, he went for his face, and he caught his ear. So, I mean, 2,000 years ago, That's a gun, right? That's your lethal weapon he's carrying on his person. Maybe Jesus didn't know he was carrying it. I don't know. Just I'll leave you with that. Anyway. You still don't know whether I'm pro-gun or not, by the way. Number four, have rigid expectations. Oh, no, is that right? Yeah, have rigid expectations. What can we expect in this life? I can tell you real quickly, nothing. You can't expect anything. You cannot expect anything. If I expect my car to start and it doesn't, I'm furious. That stupid Toyota, they said they were dependable. They should have built it better. Okay? I woke up the other day. My wife should have known that I like clean underwear. Where is it? Okay, expectations make us shit on everybody, right? You should be this, you should be that, you should do this, you should do that, and they don't. The world doesn't work the way we want it to. Apparently we're not sovereign. It's weird. I know. We should be. Should on ourselves. I do a lot of shouldn't on myself. Okay. Good way to kind of appropriate yourself some trauma. So let's get into some resilience. It's defined there. You can read that. One of the best things for resilience or resiliency, the research kind of looks at, is that we have meaningful relationships. We have deep and meaningful relationships. One of the things that love and respect about this community at Dwell. We want meaningful, deep relationships. We want to have people we're doing life with, and that it's a two-way street. They care about us. They're paying attention. They're concerned. They celebrate with us. They mourn with us, and we're paying attention to them, and we celebrate with them, and we mourn with them. That's a really important key to being resilient, because resilience is that's the strength that we need to deal with and heal from maybe trauma we've already experienced that stuck. And the more resiliency we build and develop, the more we can fight and heal effectively from those past traumatic experiences. And potentially, the more we're going to be resilient if and when, probably when, we experience other really hard things in life. All right? And so resiliency is a real important thing. And like, we have reason as believers to be the most resilient people in the world, right? Because we have a God who loves us, who walks with us, who walks within us, and who we know this little earth floating around thing is not the only deal. It's not the only thing going on, right? There's way more going on, and when this is over, we got something unimaginably better. And so we as believers need to work at developing our resiliency, okay? Not only for our mental health, but because we got to support a lot of other people that have been, knocked around. We want to care for them too. Live in gratitude. I already talked about either or thinking. Live in gratitude. Sometimes we can get in touch with our feelings of gratitude. Sometimes we can't get in touch with those feelings. I don't know if you're weird like me, where sometimes feelings are not really all that available to you. Okay, but they're probably there somewhere, maybe, I don't know. But if you can't feel the gratitude when you're like trying to get in touch with the gratitude, that's okay. Just make a list. Just start listing. Just start bullet point listing. Like, here are people that, Lord, I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for this person. I'm grateful for these things. I'm grateful for this. I'm grateful for that. Just start making as big a list as you can about what you're grateful for, okay? That's really important. Walk in a spirit of love, peace, and forgivingness, okay? That's easy, so you should know how to do that. So I did this experiment a couple weeks ago. I was in the Montreal airport. Gosh, you don't go there. It's a crap hole. And maybe it was just the day. I'm sorry if you're from Montreal, but it was not a beautiful, happy place. And I've never been in a longer snake line of trying to get to security. And I mean, it was rough because people were impatient, people were insisting on their own way, people were very self-focused, people were feeling superior and judgy, and people were shitting on people all around them, and I'm talking about mostly about me being the people doing those things. So I tried this experiment. I'm going to look at everybody here in this airport with the love of Jesus. I'm going to try to look through the lens of Jesus' love. I'm going to try to look through his eyes at everybody I see here. And I just did that for a while. And it's like, okay. And I just noticed, wow, that person's really struggling. Are these people, man, that dude's like really, really cool looking. He's got something going there. And, you know, so I just started like loving these people through the lens of Christ. And you know what, it was kind of interesting is that I started feeling a little more patient. I felt like I didn't really need to insist on my own way as much. And I'm feeling a little kinder and more at peace with all of the chaos going around, all the people trying to get to where they're going, or all the stresses they were having. Kind of gave me a sense of compassion. I thought, wow, I'm going to try that experiment again maybe next year. Right? It was pretty cool. Right? But no, like, so kind of what I did there was I repented, I guess you could put it in that kind of term. But just to say, no, we get to be loving. We get to be that because of what Jesus did. We were built to be loving beings. Okay, and that got all messed up with sin and everything. It twisted it and distorted it. But you're a loving being, and when you're reunited in Christ, okay, and God who is love, now you're in union with love, and we can be loving again. We can look and we can see and we can be love wherever we are. And so that's a wonderful part of resiliency. And last, before we get to a couple questions, I'm only 3 minutes behind where I was yesterday, and that's a little bit of a failure because I was going to try to be ahead. But oh well, it's not trauma, right? Trust in God. Here's what I've done a lot. I'm sure I will continue to do it from time to time. I'm going to distort this a little bit, and I'm going to trust in God that he will do this. I'm going to trust in God that he wants it to be this way. I'm going to trust in God that he's going to protect me from this thing. I'm going to trust in God that he's going to ultimately make this situation better. I'm going to trust in him that. I'm going to trust in him for. And it's the for that I want. It's the that I want. Okay. And again, I've done that. I'll do that. I'm do that again. But what I think is maybe about more resiliency and more about even maybe me growing in more spiritual maturity is to say, no, I'm going to trust in God. And if, and hopefully when, and I'm going to ask because he wants me to. And as Pastor Clive said, it changes the world. Prayer, our asking, our requests, our relationship with God does. I believe that. But we need to trust him in him. We need to trust in him that he is good. Trauma tries to tell us God's not good. Or maybe if he's good, he's not all powerful. And if he's all good and he's all powerful, he sure doesn't love you. Doesn't love me. Okay? Everybody else I can believe that for, but what about me? I don't think he's into me. And maybe it's because I'm just too damaged, I'm too worthless, I'm too broken. Nope. We need to trust in him, in who he is, his goodness, his love, his compassion, his mercy, his immensity, his beauty. Okay, we need to trust in him. All right, I've enjoyed it again. It's an honor. Blessings to you all. May God bless you.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.